Tonight, I am very happy to introduce Rob Schmidt, Virginia Matthews, Kenny Johnson, and Stuart Goodnick for a panel discussion addressing the question of what is spiritual practice and why engage in spiritual practice. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you all for coming tonight. We came up with the idea for this panel, and we wanted to get people with as diverse a set of experiences as we could imagine without having too unwieldy and large a set of panelists. So I'm going to be interested to hear how people respond to this question of what spiritual practice is and why engage in it myself, because I think we have a number of different perspectives that may be congruent in some ways, be different in other ways, and that will be part of the fun. So I'm feeling as if, although we haven't even talked about this, I'm feeling as if I'll sort of be the moderator a little bit and just let you guys start to talk about this issue of spiritual practice. When I wrote the description, I threw in some questions about whether belief is involved, need necessarily be involved in practice, or whether spiritual practice need have anything whatsoever to do with belief or belief systems, ideology, or whether it is to be found in other aspects of experience. So that might be one place to start, but I'm happy for any of our panelists to sort of jump in here and start responding to this question. We had a lovely dinner with Kenny last night, and it was interesting to hear him talk about his experience. So maybe I'll invite him to start.
And I'll wait for somebody else to start. Good evening, everyone. Some of you I've seen, some of you I haven't seen, so it'd be nice to get to know new faces and share my experience. I don't come from a formal practice. My teacher is Gangaji, and I met her while I was incarcerated. And if I had a practice at that time, it was doing hatha yoga or siddha yoga, a lot of meditating. And as I was, a friend and I, we would meditate every night. This was our practice, to sit and meditate every night. And so we've been meditating for about 6 months. And the purpose of our meditation, or our practice, was to realize oneness, or wake up, to experience consciousness, God. We read a few books on it, but we didn't really know how it would look. And so this one evening, I had been meditating for about 30 minutes. And everything just fell away, and I hit this terrifying place. And this inner voice or inner knowing or intuition said, if you meditate one more second, you're going to die. I stopped. I took my cushion. I put it under my bed, and I walked away from meditation. I walked away from the practice. Because in my mind, death was like I would die in prison. And I didn't want to die in prison, physically. That was my understanding. I would physically die in prison. And so time went on for about 6, 7, 8 more years. Then I met my teacher, Gangaji. And I had an interaction with her. And in that moment, I literally died. But what I have come to see in that moment, what died was that old, that criminal way of being, moving, and thinking. So my practice was pointing to a spiritual death. But since I didn't have a teacher or a sangha or to guide me, to keep me going, I simply backed up until I could find a teacher that could take me through that death phase. And so what I experienced was the death of Kenneth Johnson, the criminal. And out of that came this rebirth of this new person. And now, since 1994, when I met her, I had that experience. I have had a number of practices. I meditate, I go to the ashram, I go hear other people speak. But if there's one practice I have that does not go away, and I use it religiously, and that is watching my dreams, paying attention to my dreams. Because even after having the awakening experience, I realized there are still things I have to unravel. There are still things that I am unconscious of. And so in my practice of dream analysis or interpretation, I am able to experience the same oneness I experienced with Gangaji in the same voice that's saying you're going to die in my dream, in my dream analysis or experience. So that is what I do religiously. I write my dreams out, and I look when I walk throughout the day meditating on them, contemplating them, trying to see how this message is going to show up in my life, because I realize that this consciousness is still talking through me through my unconsciousness. So that's the practice that I have, and that's the practice that I was using before I even started meditating. I was always into dreams, but I didn't really know that that was a practice until after I got out of prison. And I said, well, I'm traveling here, I'm going there, I can't be at the ashram, I can't be at the zendo, I can't get to the church, but whenever I lay down, I'm always at the zendo, I'm always at the church, I'm always in this place of being able to commune with that which always is here. And with that, I will pass it over to someone else.
I love the way that Kenny just jumped right in and talked about dying, because that is the essence of what spiritual practice is, at least what I was taught by my teacher. When, of course, in Zen, by the way, if you don't know who I am, I'm a Rinzai Zen ordained nun, though it's a very archaic way of... We still haven't come up with a better word. And I've been practicing with my teacher, Sasaki Roshi, for 37 years. He's 103. And he's still, as he say, he's still practicing dying with us. And that is what he promised us as we go into personal interview to koan practice, is that what we're doing is practicing dying. And of course, it's a very fearful thing. When I first encountered Zen, and the images of all these really macho, gung-ho swordsmen saying, kill the self, I actually had an experience where I thought that's what you were supposed to do. And I determined in this one session that I was going to kill the self. And I remember sitting in front, before you go announce yourself to the Roshi, you sit in front of this bell. And I remember getting really worked up. My heart must have been going like 300 beats a minute. I had convinced myself that I was going to die when I walked in there, because that would be the proper answer to the koan. And I remember going in there and doing the bows and then standing up, and the Roshi, and I think I had worked myself into a state that I could have really done something to my heart. And the Roshi said, he grabbed me and he said, Zazen, which is meditation. And immediately the fear went, I breathed, and I was in a totally peaceful state. And he was, as he said, we practice dying, but we don't practice killing the physical self, as you experienced, as I experienced for that moment. And I was young. I was 24, 25 at the time. And, you know, young people are very, you know, they take things very literally. And they're very gung-ho. And then the rest of my years of being with the Roshi was to understand how to practice letting go of the self, dissolving the self, being able to enter this vast, boundless, peaceful state of being, which is our true nature. And to me, that is what spiritual practice is. And the other thing that, of course, being young and encountering Zen in the 60s and 70s when we were fresh out of college and so goal-oriented. I mean, you know, people would sit around and talk about how they were going to get enlightened in a couple of months, you know, because they were working really hard and we're bound to get enlightened, you know. We're doing all the practices, you know. There was that goal of enlightenment that was perhaps maybe a little deceptively put out there in a few of those books. I was thinking of Three Pillars of Zen was a big, you know, where enlightenment was such a goal, you know, such a goal orientation. And now 37 years later, I realize it's a process. It's a process of sitting in that vast space. I use meditation, but like you, I don't always have my cushions. I don't always have a quiet place. When I had small children, I learned how to get to that place very fast in an anywhere, whether it was standing in the post office line, whether it was sitting in the car after my kids had fallen asleep before I entered the house, because I knew if I did not touch that space, I would not be whole. And I knew what it felt like to be whole, and I knew that I needed to get to that place over and over and over and over again.
Well, I guess I'll go.
Two good stories. How are you going to top that?
So my name is Stuart Goodnick, and I have been a student of Tai meditation. I was a student of our founder, Robert Daniel Ennis, and Rob Schmidt for many years until Robert died in 1998. His training was with a kind of wild and crazy guy named E.J. Gold, and a lot of the language and a lot of the influence of our practice has been what's known as the fourth way, which is the tradition of the Gurdjieff work. Although Robert's innovations within that place it in, you know, place what we do in a slightly different category, that's one of the stronger foundational sources that we use. And to carry on with the theme of death, because I think that's a very important theme for our discussion tonight, I would characterize the fourth way tradition in our Tai tradition as something more like a death by a thousand cuts. Mm-hmm. And I'm choosing that word very carefully because for those of you familiar with Latin, you know, the root of cut is sciere, which is also to know or to see. And knowing and seeing often is associated with cutting or creating a distinction. So to say death by a thousand cuts is like a shorthand to speak about one of the primary practices in our tradition, which is self-observation. And the intention of self-observation is to cultivate from moment to moment in whatever you're doing, whatever situation you find yourself in, the ability to objectively look back upon what your organism is engaged in, what sensations are coursing through the body, what emotional state may be presenting itself, what collection of thoughts may be circulating and operating in the mind, and the collection of these activities and their interactions become the subject of our self-observation. And the reason that this represents a one of many deaths, or one of many little moments of knowing, is that with each of these moments of observation, something shifts in ourselves. And ultimately, when this is engaged in on a continuous basis over a process of many years, a phenomenon or an experience not unlike the death that's being described here is something that can be encountered. The funny thing to me is I really resonate with what Jenny was saying about the goal-orientedness of practice, because it's certainly the case in my own work that there was a moment I remember very clearly when the goal nature of the practice fell away, and it was like falling into the practice itself that became very important. And recently I've been commuting quite a bit because I have a new job down in the peninsula, and I've been listening to lots of National Public Radio. And yesterday as I was driving home, there was this story about some group in Peru that has some sort of natural herbal potion that people now are flocked to drink and go through workshops and things like that. And they were interviewing a guy who was billing himself as a shaman. And he took a course, and he said, you know, that he'd studied for 2 years and attained a master status. And I just laughed at that when I heard that, because you know, the idea that we can study 2 years and do anything that deserves the word master is funny to begin with. But this kind of practice that we're talking about is really a life's work. And so, you know, when I look at the question of what is spiritual practice or what is you know, spiritual work, the first thing that comes to mind is that it is a life's work. It's a way of being. It's a way of organizing our life. It's not so much an end goal or a technique to get something. It becomes a way that we reorganize our experience.
Thank you. So I think this is a good time to open up to any questions that you might have that have arisen.
Sure. A lot of like teachers or different traditions talk about. Actually, when I started out, I heard this notion of something like radical that could happen if you worked really hard, and I was like, yeah, what's that about? And so I'm just wondering, like, from your perspectives, I mean, you guys are talking a lot about process and time. Is it the kind of thing where, like, you know, at some point something, like, really shifts, or is it a gradual process that you one day turn around and you say, okay, now this is radically different than it was, you know, a decade ago? Or is it radical at all, or what?
Or both.
Well, Zen, I think, is one of the systems that does talk about enlightenment. Not all systems do. And if you're familiar with Zen at all, there's the school of the gradual enlightenment and the sudden enlightenment. And in the school of sudden enlightenment, like what Kenny was saying, is that through his dream, sometimes you get a radical insight that you can't, your rational mind is puts up a lot of barriers. So in Rinzai Zen, the koan practice is a way to bypass, it's like sneaking up and saying, surprise! and that's what a Zen master is trained to do, is to know where the student is in their practice and hopefully catch that moment where you can say, boo, and something really drops. Now, how deep does that realization go? My teacher doesn't talk about enlightenment. He talks about Kensho experiences, those moments, those moments of realization. Because unless you incorporate them and deepen them in your practice, that it's a nice aha moment, but it's not going to be of service. So that's why we always go back to practice, practice, practice. Even though there is this place for aha realization moments.
Thank you.
And I would say that for all things are possible for consciousness. All things are possible. Radical awakening, a gradual awakening. But is that possible for you? I mean, that's the question you're asking. Right. And so the path that you're on is, what would you say?
Are you asking if it's
right? Yeah. What path are you? The path that you're on, what would you call it?
Gradual or radical, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I guess I've noticed I haven't been doing it very long relative to any of you, but I've noticed changes and surprising changes. I've learned things that I didn't expect to know about, but I guess I'm still curious if there's going to be like this someday, this completely new radical perspective on my life or something. So far it seems gradual, but I'm waiting.
We shall wait and see.
I guess.
Do you know that great saying of his name is Osho now, but Rajneesh.
Yeah.
When he was Rajneesh, he was asked, he said, practice does not lead to realization, does not directly lead to realization. So it's an accident. It's something that happens. Like a moment, like grace, he said, so why do we practice? And he said, so we can become accident prone.
Yeah, that's my dad.
Well, there's a sort of another quote from a teacher, a spiritual teacher named Leo Osowick, that speaks to this issue, where I remember one talk he gave where he seemed to be particularly cranky, and he would talk about how enlightenment is easy. You know, enlightenment, you know, anyone can be enlightened. What practice is about is taking the moment of enlightenment and bringing it operationally into your life, bringing it into your life in such a way that you can be a vehicle of service, to be a container of that. And that's the hard part.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there is a place for kenshos moments of great expansion, and sometimes they're small, sometimes they're big. But certainly in my experience, the hard part is the aftermath of that, which is, okay, now that I come down, what do I do with that? Mm. How do I take responsibility for that scene? And that's where practice, to me, becomes real and necessary. Otherwise, in a way, just those experiences serve as a form of entertainment.
Well...
No, jump in.
I'm not sure I would agree with the idea of entertainment. I read in the current issue of Shambhala, I think I quoted it actually last time I spoke a few weeks ago, but it really stuck with me. The Tibetan teacher Tokul Urkin was explaining to his son about practice, and he said, you get an understanding, and then you have experiences, and you practice to stabilize the understanding until they become experiences, and then you practice so that the experiences become your realization. So that it's not that they're entertainment, it's the Tibetans say you're building familiarity with the state. And you continue to practice, you get more and more familiar with what that state looks like. So
feels like.
Hmm?
Feels like.
Yeah. I mean, feels like. It's that those experiences aren't entertainment. They're short-lived, but they serve as a way of familiarizing yourself with over and over again. Even if somehow you don't actualize it in your daily life, which is possible at some point, you know, there still could be a separation. But you're becoming more and more familiar with what's possible until it becomes stable.
Certainly willing. I don't disagree with what you're saying, but it does call up a question for me. And what I notice in different forms of spiritual work and spiritual practice take is that, you know, in some cases there's a fixation on experiences, and in other cases there's a focus on service. And it's not like one is right and one is wrong, but I guess I found that. I've seen in myself phases where I thought the experience, or having a particular kind of experience, was it. And that has seemed to be less and less relevant. That it's about something else. And that there's understandings I might have, and there might be states I can experience that seem profound and open and expansive, but in a way those seem like byproducts. And that maybe I'm not sure how to get to this, but the experiences feel like byproducts to me of something else. And that something else, the closest I can come to that, or the closest I have been able to articulate it to myself, is surrendering to being of service. And that's, there's something to me that's deeper in that, because you know it's not about me doing anything, or it's not about me attaining to anything. It's about moment by moment trying to be useful to the creation. So that's what comes up in connection with that.
Well, I think they go together. Mm-hmm. If you look at the Bodhisattva
vow, wisdom and compassion.
Your commitment is to enlightenment for the purpose of serving others. So your mindset is being of service, and the experiences are the thing that expands you enough to completely continue to stabilize you, so this small self drops away. So anyway, I think they go together, but mm-hmm. I can see that you could emphasize one or the other. Sorry.
I see a hand over there.
The word practice has arisen many times now. I'd be interested in some comment as to what constitutes practice, what is it, and is practice the point at which one personally manifests spirituality or interaction with spirituality?
Oh, then you're asking two questions. What's spirituality to? Tough ones.
Well, that harkens back to it. You asked, are beliefs necessary? Because some practices, religious or spiritual practices, do come out of a belief system. And if you were to take... I'm not that familiar with Christianity, but there is a certain belief that in a belief system that there are practices, at least in the Catholic Church, let's say, that go along with that belief system, and those are their practices. Whether you take communion, I think there are seven sacraments.
Seven sacraments.
And so those practices seem very wedded to a particular belief system. Many of us are kind of winging it in you know, as we have exposure to many different belief systems. Even though I'm in a fairly traditional Zen practice, my teacher's saying, this is America. You know, this is America in the 21st century. This is not Japan. This is, women and men wouldn't even be practicing together. We wouldn't be sitting in a zendo together. So immediately, already the practices look different. And I further extrapolated was even though the belief system says you should sit down for at least 45 minutes to an hour on your cushion every day, I don't get to do that as a working mom. So I take those practices still a little further away from the party line. It seems to me that practices in spiritual traditions of the 21st century in America are an evolving state.
We have a reaction.
Because she knows about Catholicism.
I know about Christianity, not about Catholicism. Yeah. And I think... well, they're not mutually exclusive in that. I think that Christianity is moving into being a process rather than a set of beliefs. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a healthy thing. And mm-hmm. the people that I'm... fortunate enough to interact with, and the spiritual teachers that I encounter where I live are all on this page. Mm-hmm. And that's quite different from thinking you have to have a belief. You don't have to have that belief. You can go back to the figure of Christ and act with a sense of service, wanting to let Christ work through you as a process. Mm-hmm. And I think that is what Christianity is moving toward now, in the United States at least.
Mm-hmm. That's good to hear.
I wanted to also then respond to the question of practice to carry that theme a little forward. The notions that come up for me with regard to practice is first intention, and then there's a concept that is evolved in some forms or some writings in the fourth way, which is self-remembering. And the way I understand that in the context of this question is that we can remember ourselves as spiritual beings, whatever that means, and we can talk about that, but we can remember ourselves. We can have the intention to remember ourselves. And then whatever physical forms that takes, whether it's a interior practice of self-observation like I was describing, whether it's a involved practice of a ritual, when it's it could be meditation, but when it's done with that intention to remember oneself, to collect oneself from the many fragments into a unity, and that's engaged in over and over again, whatever the exterior form takes, that intention creates a kind of magnetism that is the foundation of what I would call practice. And the reason I make that distinction is that there's lots of different forms of spiritual techniques and technology, and I would assert that they do something entirely different if that intention to remember oneself as a spiritual being is not there. You know, a good example that I often used in talks like this is I think it's Phil Jackson, the basketball coach, who mm-hmm. had his players studying Zen meditation so that they could improve their shots. Now, as a byproduct of their focus on basketball, maybe some of them got closer to a spiritual consciousness about themselves, but I would assert that that was not a spiritual practice. That was a basketball technique. And yet, the form was the same as the practices that Jenny was talking about. So, to me, the intention, we need to start with the intention, start with what is the interior practice, and then the exterior forms are many and varied, but as long as that interior practice is there, then practitioners of very, very different traditions will recognize each other.
I found myself a few minutes ago remembering the first time I spoke in a group, first time I heard my voice. It was a liberal religious youth, Unitarian. It was a seminar, and I remember that the shift, the sudden shift, and realizing that before I spoke, there was, and I didn't know, maybe I didn't know it, but there was something that was being left out, or I was feeling left out, something was feeling, and then suddenly I wasn't feeling left out. So it's like the spiritual practice has to do with making sure that no voice inside of you is going unheard, and no voice in those around us is going unheard. So it's looking for a context that is just so inclusive, like the earth is inclusive, it includes all of us. It is its own spiritual practice. So it's like the person who is not speaking feels equally included, because the context is so vibrant and so alive and so inclusive in itself that you don't even have to say anything to feel included. And that's kind of like implicitly spiritual, because that's the the it's being there in the unifying principle.
That's the benefit of group worship, I think.
That is the benefit of group worship. Yeah.
And when you say that, in my practice of watching my dreams, I realize every voice, everything in the dream is me. So I have to pay attention to all the voices, not just one that seems what I want, but here's a voice that's sort of saying something dark, and here's something saying something light, and here's something that's not saying anything. And there's all the different figures and the energy and the colors. So I have to really pay attention to everything in the dream, because those messages come from all different aspects of that. You know, consciousness has many voices. And so that's when I look at the dream, or I ask myself, I say, pay attention to the dream. I say, well, everybody in there is you. And so what is happening? You know, just how are these voices speaking to you? And so that is the way I continue to stay open to listen to everybody's viewpoint, because everybody has a different, but consciousness is talking through each and every one of you. Yes.
What I hear is that we're looking at spiritual practices, and everyone has a stream. I do the dreams, and I do the Guru, and I do the Zen.
Right.
Separation. And the goal that seems to be oriented is enlightenment. So then it's a goal-oriented practices. What I hear here is everything is a spiritual practice if you intend it to be the same, and you look at it as life is a spiritual practice, and you can bow to the Buddha, you can bow to Jesus, you can do it all, you know, like, with a sense of unity, that every voice counts and every action counts, and no judgment, no separation, good, bad, beautiful, ugly, desired, averted, all that. So.
Well, that's the key. When Bodhidharma came to China, he was asked what the essence of Buddhism is, and he said, boundless vastness and nothing holy. And it's a very deep teaching, that nothing is better than anything else, that you're holding in the state of the absolute. Well, I'm going to use Buddhist terms because that's my training, in the state of the absolute. But we don't get to stay in that state. We don't get to stay, if you've ever done a 7-day retreat like I do, in total silence. We don't even, you know, you keep your eyes down. We keep our eyes open, but we don't look in each other's face. We just move together as a group. We never speak to each other. And you, by the end of that, you feel totally unified until suddenly you look up, wow, I didn't notice those blue eyes. And, that person's voice is really grating. And, you know, and then suddenly, you know, the absolute dissolves into the particular, and all those little judgments come up. And, of course, if you practice, you let those go. You don't hook on and say, well, I'm not going to speak to that guy because his voice is really annoying me. Because hopefully you've done the practice to know that that's just one other aspect, you know, like a yellow daisy and a blue daisy or purple daisy. But there are very few of us who can take that wisdom of the absolute on a moment-to-moment daily basis. It seems like we're always falling flat on our face. Spiritual practitioners, as well as non-spiritual practitioners, are always falling flat on our face. But I do believe the practices help you stand up and try again.
True.
And take that step again. And even means falling flat on your face again. But to have had that experience of that oneness of the absolute, you have some sort of belief, faith or experience.
I wanted to say something about practice as having continuity in time, perseverance. Because in a way, it sounds like there are many different spiritual practices. And but it seems like a practice, if you stay with one thing, I think there's a tendency, I know for myself, I read this, I read that in my mind. But if you stay with doing the same thing, almost no matter what it is, that continuity is going to show you something about yourself, about the way things are. It's almost anyway, I just like, that's what came to me, that there's mm-hmm. something important about a practice continuing.
Commitment, that commitment.
So just to add to that, the 4th century Yogi Patanjali wrote the Yoga Sutras, and he said practice should be uninterrupted and continuous, and the word is abhyasa, which is that continuous practice is what gives you results.
Yeah.
He would agree with mm-hmm. you from the 4th century.
My own experience of years of many years of practice and different practices, especially in recent years, is that there's been a seeing through that's happened in the course of it that has markedly shifted the way I perceive my life, my life, my own conditioning, and it's made, and it was a big statement, but I'll try it out, made everything seem more transparent, and in that process, it's something has liberated. Now, I can't say I'm not caught by ego or personality or conditioning or whatever. It's like I hold myself, I hold life differently. And that's come out of practice. It's come out of direct seeing. I'll put it that way. It's come out mm-hmm. of direct experience and seeing. And it's not a one-time seeing, although I've had big, dramatic, awakening kinds of experience. But come out of a kind of consistency of seeing, and it's really changed my sense of reality, which in turn has profoundly impacted my life and the way I live it. So I'd love to hear from you how years of practice may have shifted your experience of yourself and or your experience of life in terms of service. Through it all feels to me like I'm more available to life, to others, whether you call that service. I mean, I do my service because I choose to, but I can't say that comes out of meditation. That's anything that emerged from meditation. It comes out of my ethical values and my social and cultural values more, and the pleasure of it. So, but I think what's more significant is how I am in relationship to what goes on around me, and that's definitely not consistent.
Well, let me take that question, which I think is a good one to ask our panelists. Thank you, and maybe just add or emphasize one part of the question, which it seems to me is where do people start off when they feel the urge to practice, which actually gets to the second question that was in the title for this talk: why engage in spiritual practice? Mm. Where are we starting from when the inclination to begin starts, and what are we constantly encountering, if there is a consistent way to describe that, as we're struggling to make practice or practices continuous in the way that Patanjali, that we're told Patanjali advocated. So I think that's an interesting question. So thank you.
I do want to note that what's your name?
Marjorie
brought up the big L word that all spiritual practice promises, which is liberation.
Mm-hmm. I can't say I was talking about ultimate liberation. Anyway, that's not what I was.
But that's an important
being freed of certain assumptions, certain mm-hmm. levels of conditioning, certain beliefs, certain enculturations, mm-hmm.
It feels like
seeing through, and right. It's the seeing through that mm-hmm. is liberating. Right. I don't claim to have the ultimate, whatever that ultimate liberation.
Who knows what ultimate is? But the sense that you said, that sense of freedom, that sense of because you can see through now, that yeah. sense of not being dragged down by your conditioning all the time.
I guess I would speak to that to kind of turn that around, which is, in one sense, I can say I've shared that experience of having levels of conditioning drop away, but at the same time, in the course of my practice, I've noticed that my sense of discrimination has become heightened, such that I am aware of subtler and subtler levels of conditioning that are in operation in myself. So experientially, I don't know that I can say that I've seen things drop away as much as the character of what has kept me conditioned has shifted, certainly. But I certainly wouldn't ever, you know, feel motivated to present myself as liberated in that sense, because I see very clearly factors in my common presence that are still bound. Now, are they bound the same way that someone who is sort of consumed by passion and violence are consumed? No, but they still seem very real and very much the subject of ongoing work and ongoing practice.
But I do want to answer, because I too, having crossed that lovely line of being 60, I do feel some of the fruits of my practices, which I thought was articulated beautifully by Pema Chodron, the Tibetan Buddhist, who has devoted, you know, herself to practice and has particularly talked about what she calls the shenpas, the shackles, hooks, that's the word. Now, we call it in Buddhism attachments, but as she says, that's such a wimpy word. It's really this hook that just grabs you and holds you fast. So she's devoted a lot of her time to talking about that. And so this lovely young woman was interviewing her, and she said, well, with all your practices, you must be so free, you know, so free of these hooks. And she said, no, I'm not free. I just get to laugh at myself now. I get to see these things arising, and I don't take it so seriously. It's not the big drama it was when I was 22. It's still there. It still arises. But I have spent so much time in self-inquiry, which is what meditation really is, seeing this over and over and over again, that I can get to the point. And I feel that myself too. And I think it does have something to do with crossing into a later stage of your life to be able to be a little more amused at yourself. And I always feel that the essence, I always get very worried when I hear speakers about spiritual practice. If they take things too seriously, something's wrong. So I appreciate that sense of lightness and laughter and just laughing at myself for getting hooked. Once again, for the 90,000th time, that hooked me again. But I now can see it, laugh at it, and let it go.
And there's something else I'd like to say, which I haven't heard any of you speak of. I don't have a sense of a solidity of self that I had. When I look, there is, it's not so bound, this is not so bound, it's much more in flow, it's much larger, it just feels less solid, and like this in the body is bag of you know, bones. Doesn't feel like who I really am. So I respond to my name and I go about, you know, my vitamins in the morning, you know, the whole routine. But there's something liberating. by not, by the identification, not being so solidly with this name and this lifestyle. And it just feels so much more freeing. It feels very real to me. So, and that's come out of what I see, what I experience in the space of silence and looking.
Mm.
So, you know, it's not unique to me. It certainly shows up all kinds of teachings. And it's life-changing for me. I mean, radically life-changing? I don't know. I can't say that. But definitely life-changing. So I'm curious about where that, if that shows up, where that shows up in people's practice. Is it meaningful? Is it whatever?
Yeah. I'm thinking that one way your practice, yours and Rob's and the Tayu Meditation Center practice differs. I know self-observation is a big part of it, but another big part of it is looking outward rather than inward. And the form of meditation you use, the eye-to-eye meditation.
The co-meditation.
Co-meditation is one facet of that. And isn't that something that Robert introduced into your practice that makes it different from some other practices?
Well, it's certainly something that is different than I've seen forms of it in other practices, but the way I would kind of characterize this is it's a practice of, Gurdjieff used the term external considering. It's seeing another and seeing the being of another, seeing your beingness in another, and putting attention on other to recognize the self in other. And it's certainly a different character, you know, in our practice, and it's one of the reasons behind it, or the emphasis of it, is to train practitioners to put their attention on something other than their own internal considerations, and it's sort of a prelude to a practice of being of service, because it's being of service by giving full attention to something outside of yourself, which in ordinary conditioned mind is a pretty difficult and uncommon thing. So I won't claim that practice is exclusive to us, but it's certainly a unique flavor of the work that we do.
It actually occurs to me to ask a question I've always wanted to ask Kenny about this, actually, because for a long time, Kenny has spoken several times in the store before, and he's described at considerable detail, and sometimes with some of the folks he's worked with, who had been prisoners when he's gone back into prisons, mm-hmm. and established opportunities for kind of unmediated dialogue, I guess,
right.
with people. And I'm wondering if what Stuart's saying has any resonance with that, or how it's different, and how you would describe that.
There's two things. I want to speak of, I'm going back to my dreams here. One of my practices now is to see every animal as a helpful animal, and that whenever they speak, actually listen. For the longest, I had an aversion to certain animals, and I had my judgments. And so this has been a real challenge for me to wake up every morning and look out and see every animal has a voice. And it's a helpful voice, and to see how I am separating myself, or judging myself, or criticizing. You know, I see all the things that come up in me, and just having that practice, seeing every animal as a helpful voice. So when it comes in your dream, you know, you'll be able to listen to it, and that is such a big challenge to me, because lion. Show for my dream, and it used to be gorillas to show for my dream all the time. And so it's just really a challenge for me to see all animals as speaking to me and giving me advice and guidance. And that's where I'm at right now in my practice. So last night I had a dream about praying mantis coming to my window, and it's And then it went into the bushes. And I have been meditating it all day. What does that mean? You know, this big old praying mantis, you know, giant one, then it got smaller and went into the bushes. And it was a kind animal. You know, so I've been just meditating and contemplating that for the last 12 hours or so. I've been went out into the park and just looked at the grass and looked at the scene, just trying to get the message that the dream was sending me, that the animal would help, the animal was sending to me. And to go to your next question, when I went into San Quentin and to the prisons, we would create a circle and we would have to, I would make it almost a point, let's just look at each other, let's just see each other, and let's actually connect with each other and talk to each other. And that has been so beneficial because most people in prison don't get opportunity to sit in a circle such as this and to make eye contact and to share what's going on. Because you can't really be vulnerable in prison, you know, open it up. And so that is the practice that we do in San Quentin. That's the only program I have, where we sit in a circle and we actually connect with each other. We actually sit and listen to the person and have compassion for the person. Because this is probably the only hour or 2 hours they have opportunity to drop the guard and to be vulnerable. And so I'm sure that what you're speaking of is just when you're sitting face to face, there's an opportunity to drop the guard and just to be totally present to that person without judging them or judging them. That's the best question. Mm-hmm. So I think, I'm Edgar.
You're going to say it, but it takes practice.
It takes practice, and that's right. And, and you're constantly seeing where you're falling short. I see where I'm steady falling short. Well, that dog's a little ugly, mangy dog. I wouldn't want that dog talking to me. You know, I'm just, that's just what I say to myself. Mm-hmm. So it's really a practice to look at, you know, it's a challenge. Mm-hmm. You know, because I wasn't raised an animal lover. You know, we in our community, they was very cruel to animals, very cruel to birds. And so now to take and make that a practice, as the whereas out here in California, people just love animals like, you know, you know, oh, the poor cat, you know what I mean? You know, where I came from, they would have shot the cat, you know? You know, I mean, that's, so for me to be able to change my whole way of seeing animals, it's really been a great practice for me. It has really been a challenge.
Well, how do you see the animals?
I'm struggling with, how do I see him?
Yeah, what kind of an entity is it? What is the messaging for you?
But the messaging for me is to see that we're all one. Even the animal kingdom and the plant kingdom, we're one. And I just saw that if you're not black, you're not Eskimo, or you're not this, well, you're not one. Or you're not in a certain spiritual community, we're not one. And I have learned by, over the years since I've been out of prison, that the Christian, you know, I was raised a Christian, you know, I practiced Islam, and I started meditating, and so I see myself as one, you know, with all the religions. That's the easy part, to see myself as one with all the religions. And now is to see myself one with different things that I had no idea that I had a separation to. And the biggest one for me right now is animals. So that's my practice right now.
I guess it can be applied to people too, huh?
Yeah, it's. I mean, yeah, and then that translates into seeing people, you know, because I had such an aversion to animals, the way if I can just really listen to an animal talk to me, then I'm open. That can point to whereas I won't listen to this gentleman or this gentleman say something to me that can be helpful or beneficial. Okay.
Christian had his hand.
I'd like to make two statements. One is, what Kenny's describing is very shamanistic. All shamans have animal helpers, and they listen to them, and they work with them, and they get guided by them. That's beautiful stuff you were just describing.
Right, right.
I'm feeling like there's some lack of distinction between spiritual practice and spiritual techniques. Sitting on a cushion, saying the rosary is a technique. I would see that in spirituality, we are trying to achieve an awareness of, be it the self with the big S, God, Tao, what have you. And that what practice is a constant 24/7 dedication of intention and will. I really like that. I thought that was very nice, the intention stuff. Of putting yourself into a state of mind so that you are in union and you have an awareness of that greater reality, that unification with it, your melding with it, your loss of the self comes up in that kind of a situation. And practice is doing it all the time. And I think that's unique to spirituality, that you have to put that kind of effort into it. And it's what drives spiritual people, is that you're willing to devote 24/7 to attaining this state of mind where you have that awareness and you have that contact, you have that unification.
That lady, right? She hadn't spoke.
Well, I was moved by earlier. You said that every part of the dream is yourself, and I practice that. Also, I love dream work, and I've learned long ago and tried to do it. When I look at the dreams, that I am part of it. So I'm thinking, when you say you're afraid of animals, well, that, according to what you've said earlier, would be part of you, wouldn't it?
Yes, and this is my practice, to see how that is a part of my animal nature, my animalistic instinct nature, you know, because animals, they act instinctually, you know, and so how do I act instinctually? So listen to my instinct.
So you don't take it
there. It's a symbolic way of listening. Now, I'm learning that but first I have to make peace with this animal first. You know, see it as myself. I'm sorry, not you. This animal.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a bad animal.
What if you reversed it? You got friendly with that part of you inside
And that's the practice.
Then you'd be friendly with the animal, I guess.
Well, you know, first thing I see outside. I see out there, and I immediately judge out there, and it's my projections out there, and how to turn that projection back into myself. This is just actually where I am now. So as I throw this out there, people don't give me the piece of knowledge and information that I can use to even deepen my practice and my experience and my connection to myself.
Well, I found the other thing that was extremely useful, a technique, I guess, dialogue work by Byron Prokop especially, where he takes everything, dream or anywhere, and dialogues with it. And you know,
yes.
Take out the voice of both parts. And try not to think, of course, to get deep in your meditation or whatever, and allow these voices, especially if you can write it. And I've been amazed at solutions that come out through that technique.
Mm-hmm.
But I can then take them in a spiritual direction, because now I've learned something about myself that can be helpful for my life. That's been helpful to me.
I'd like to say something about techniques and rituals. I don't like that word technique applied to spiritual work particularly, because I think rituals are very important. What you're trying to achieve is a luminous state where you're open. And rituals actually help do that, and from time immemorial people have had rituals that brought them into this state of mind.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe they're very important.
Mm-hmm. Another form of practice.
Another form of practice.
I think a ritual is lifted to a more state of grace or connecting with the divine, whereas a technique is something you learn from me in the book, doing this way. I love ritual. I feel like it takes me to a whole other place. They're numinous.
But that's an interesting idea to make in some traditions, you make your morning meditation part of a ritual, as opposed to, it's my morning meditation, I just plop myself down and practice the technique of focusing on my breath. It becomes part of a ritual of preparing myself to meet, you know, my greater self, and how I dress, where I sit, all become part of that ritual and changes it.
If you can approach it that way.
I wanted to say earlier, when Marjorie was talking about the her sense of herself being less solid, it reminded me of the really great question of who am I, which is really kind of unanswerable, and the whole idea of questions, and having a question in your practice is what helps deepen the practice, and Anyway, I suspect that we're all part of something much larger than we can grasp with our, you know, current understanding. Maybe in those moments, that's what we connect with. But certainly my talking mind isn't going to be in contact with that. And I also think it's important to realize that we fail. I've been reading a book by Greg Bogart about dream healing. And it's really interesting. He sees that as a way to become your authentic self.
That's true.
And I, in fact, that was, you're talking about dreams, I felt was why I came here tonight. Because I'm really interested in this, and I have been for a long time. I decided I would write down my dreams. I've been having more dreams or aware of them since I've been reading this book. And I wrote down some, but it's the practice of writing it down that I have difficulty with. I'm just like that. I don't, you know, so there's a little bit of a struggle for me.
That's your practice, though.
It's a, yes. And now I'm trying to get a message about it.
You have to confront the thing that you're averse to.
Right, right.
You don't want to do. You have
we
to,
have right. to not judge ourselves, too, but not, you know, excuse ourselves. Too easily.
Can I say that what I'm experiencing is that what my practice of dream work does is when I have a shock in the dream, something terrifying, and I wake up, then I realize how close I am to the divine. This is real. This is serious. This is no joke. And it's quite terrifying to me sometimes to realize how I, you know, just laugh it off and joke it off. Then also I have a shock and I'm like, whoa, this is real. Consciousness is not playing with me. I got to really pay attention here. Or it's going to crush me. Because it doesn't really care about me. It doesn't really care. You got to pay attention in order to get the message. That's why I do it, because it keeps me like, face to face with what I'm not, how I'm acting unconsciously, or not really listening to what consciousness is trying to get to me, what message is trying to get to me.
And is there a different intention in healing as in spiritual practice?
That's a good question.
That's a good one. Whoa.
So what's your answer?
That's a good one.
Is there a different intention if you set on this on the path to heal than to set to realize the divine? Let's put it that way. And I guess I would you said the question of who am I? Well, our Roshi, when he came to America, that was a very important Zen koan you often gave to beginners. Who am I? He said, but in America, it drove them crazy. He said that was something Americans could not handle, that question, who am I? So he came up with many different koans, like where's your true home, or how do you realize the Buddha nature when you greet your loved one? You know, he had many beautiful koans. But the one thing that he did say was, it takes a healthy self to die. That healing, he implied that healing was an important part of the process, because until the self was healthy enough, it would never be able to let go. It would never be able to surrender and dissolve, because it would be, he called it like a crack. And the Roshi accepted everyone who came to him, schizophrenics, manic depressives, you know, he didn't care. I mean, he was teaching the Dharma, but there were times he would look around the hall and he would shake as he said, I guess we have a hospital here.
I like that.
And he had seen how the practices, the very specific practices that were designed for these for Japanese young men, were able to heal some of these cracks, and they were able to go on. But it's not necessarily true for Americans. And so we had to go off and find our own healing. And it was until I did that that actually the practices were available to me. Otherwise, I kept slipping through the cracks. And so I do think healing is part of the process, but it's not the ultimate intention. I guess that's how I would answer.
That's a pretty good answer.
Yeah,
thank you.
That's a great answer.
I'm going to get a cup of tea.
I guess I do. Would you not say that the practice is designed to make God real? The whole purpose? Yeah. However you see God? However you experience God, to make it real in your life, palpable, mm-hmm. actually palpable.
Well, it helps you draw away all the roles and the exterior fears. And that, to me, would be getting the closest I could to God, to being God. And I like when you chant here, and you first say, I am, hopefully getting closer to understanding, not understanding, you know, even mine, but the we just are. I am a being with a spiritual being, you know, with a human body.
Yes.
And so the words I am, I can just meditate on that. Mm-hmm.
There's a pithy expression of practice that Arnaud Desjardins, the French master, has used. And the way I would characterize it in this dialogue is that spiritual practice is the ongoing saying of yes to life. And reflecting on that is a great challenge, because the problem with pithiness is it sounds really simple, but actually saying yes to life calls, in my own work, up to moments where I'm actually saying no to life, just like you were describing, saying no to the mangy dog.
Yeah.
You know, it's like there's a... we find lots of mangy dogs in our world, and learning to say yes to that constantly is probably the most distilled form of practice that I can find, because it captures a lot. That's what we're trying to do, and much of what we've talked about in terms of unity, openness, identity, can be found in that, because when we say yes, we're just with it.
Do you know that lovely story? Well, lovely. It was a story when Desjardins experienced a rather large heart attack.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they were carrying him out of the meditation hall. And you could see his lips moving, and one of the persons bent down, and you could hear him saying, wait. Yes, every moment of this heart attack he was saying yes to.
Yeah, and actually I think when he spoke of that, that was profound for him, in the sense that it was kind of a realization or a test that yes, the practice is with me in this place.
Yes.
It was here.
Yes.
I wasn't sure before, but here it was. That gets us back to our theme of death that we started this with.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is that so many traditions speak of practice as preparing ourselves to die. It may be to prepare ourselves to die moment to moment, but we all have this wonderful laboratory awaiting us, where we get to, you know, it's the great philosophical lab where we get to perform the test all by ourselves about what this is about, and that's coming. And so practice is in part a way to prepare ourselves.
Right. For the death of some would call death the dark side, the darkness, you know, death which you don't want. Preparing you for that which you don't want, which you're running from. And so the practice over the years prepared him for this heart attack.
Curious to hear, really all long-time practitioners, how, if at all, long-time practice has changed you, has impacted you in your life. What's different? Is anything different?
Well, I'm free of prison, so. That's how it changed me. That's I'm no longer robbing banks. That's how it changed me.
That's a pretty good
change. That's easy for me.
I think you win.
The practice of reading and praying and all that. I'm out here, so I'm cool.
For me, I was able to say yes to being a mother, which was something I had no faith in that I could do, because my mother was mentally ill, and so I didn't have a good example. But I think the practice with this loving, compassionate practice I did with the Roshi revealed to me that we all have this capacity for great love and compassion. And I was able, and because of my work with him, I was able to trust that. I trusted enough to take that plunge. And the universe definitely decided this was a good lesson, because I have 3 boys. And the third one was not expected, but it was great. It was ultimate practice. And it still is.
I guess I would say one thing that arises for me now, it's a difficult question, because in a way, just as you described that the sense of self becomes more fluid, the asking the question, or the question itself, you know, challenges me, because it's sort of fixes me in a sense. You know, if anything, my relationship to self has become more of a process where the boundaries really aren't particularly well defined, then how that flow has changed almost doesn't make sense. But I can look at certain things, and I can see, you know, certain themes that arise in practice that come up. One of which is, I was a youngest child, and you know, that's a sort of a special place that also has an opportunity of being very self-involved. And so in one sense, one theme of practice that I notice is just working with working to be unself-consciously generous. And there are ways in which that manifests in my life where I wouldn't, it's only the question that elicits that answer, because otherwise I wouldn't, my internal experience isn't even frame things in that way. It's simply that that's something that if I look at markers, I can say, yes, there's been a change in that kind of relationship to my life and the people in my life. But it's not a well-formed question, or doesn't, I have to sort of put on a mask in order to answer the question.
Well, actually, it interested me, the first part of your answer, which was the sense of self as fluid, and how that shapes your life. I mean, that seems to me a big change,
Yeah, I mean, it's true that
separate from the specific manifestation.
I could see that. You know, one of the senses of practice that when, particularly with self-observation, you're always looking at the eyes, as we call them, the sort of psychological fragments that assert, you know, constantly, you know, the crowd that asserts that as a result of various triggers. And I notice that, you know, my identification with what is me has shifted. So am I a member of a family? Am I a member of a group, like a fraternity? Am I a member of a country? Am I a member of a religion or a group? Am I the contents of this body? You know, all of that stuff. Well, all of the above and none of the above. You know, it's then ultimately with practice, when I contemplate or turn my attention to the absolute, then there's no distinction, and yet there is distinction too. And one of the paradoxes and mysteries that I find most enjoyable, that I don't really, my rational mind can't really have an answer to, is that interesting dual state we live in of non-duality and duality. Lee Loswick refers to that as enlightened duality. You know, it's the paradox that we are things, we are objects, we live in an objective world, and yet there's non-objectivity.
Thank you. Any final questions, comments?
One final comment. I've been studying the spirituality of conversation for the better part of my life. I love to look at the conversation that's going on between the first word and the last word in a sentence. And all of the other words. They're all talking to each other. And each spirituality in its own way, and each religion in its own way, is its own conversation with the eternal character of existence. So for me, the spirituality of conversation strings them all together, like beads on a single strand. As far as searching for a unifying principle is concerned, as far as I'm concerned, I found it there, because and it has to do with including God in the conversation. Because when you're there, you're there. Because we're swimming in this eternal conversation every moment. And just finding that way to acknowledge the enormity of what is going on in this instant, this moment, that everything in creation is talking to everything else, and everything and the whole creation is giving its full attention to it. Every atom, everything is an equal in that enormous, remarkable conversation. Anyway, that's my spiritual practice.
I'm also swimming in my internal conversation for now.
Go ahead.
Say yes to that.
Yes, say yes to that. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I want to point out that in a conversation such as we've been having, it might be easy to fall into platitudinous truths, but I think I want to invite you all to salute our panelists here for avoiding that trap with skill and elegance. So thank you so much, panelists. And thank you all for coming tonight. Daniel, you have